FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 10, Episode 10, Blinders. In this week's episode, we went through all of the forensics testimony that came out in Jennifer's trial, which amounted to a solid 30 minutes of trial time. And we also covered some timing issues, including the time of death that was noted on the autopsy report. Joined again with Zach here with me in person.
Hey, guys.
And Mike is joining us remotely via Zoom.
What's up, guys?
And I want to go ahead and get started because before we get into your questions, there's been a couple updates in a couple of cases that we've talked about before that I just want to chat about just for a couple minutes.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications. And that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so before we get into questions about this week's episode of Truth and Justice, I want to throw a big shout out to fellow true crime podcaster Chris Lambert, who we had on season 9. I don't remember the episode number. But his episode is also going to be on the bonus episode of True Crime Binge tomorrow. So Chris Lambert hosts the Your Own Backyard podcast. He's a musician who decided to take up the torch for trying to find justice for Kristen Smart, a Cal Polytech student that went missing in 1996, reopened the investigation on his own and really got the ball moving. He made some connections to police in the case. To try to work with them, brought out new witnesses, breathed new life into the case. And because directly, no questions asked, because of his work, two people just yesterday when we're recording this, it was Tuesday, were finally arrested 25 years later after Kristen went missing. And in the I watched it, it's online. You can see it. If you go to any of Chris's social media, you'll see it. But in the press conference where the arrests were announced, the sheriff giving it said, because of the podcast that Chris interviewed a witness they hadn't heard before, and then he passed that on to them. So then they went and talked to that witness. She said then gave them enough information to get a warrant, and they went, and then through that warrant, they gathered more evidence that allowed them to get another warrant. I think they said they even tapped the phone lines or electronic communications of Paul Flores and his father. And they said through that, that gave them enough evidence to get another warrant. Just a couple of weeks ago, they executed search warrants at Paul Flores and his dad's house, I believe. And through this announcement, they said through that execution of that search warrant, they found enough evidence to where they have arrested and charged Paul Flores with murder, with the murder of Kristen Smart, with no bail, which typically is an indicator that, because you know they have to convince a judge not to issue bail, so that's usually an indicator that they were able to present some pretty strong evidence. Obviously, still innocent till proven guilty, but he's been arrested, no bail for murder, and his father was arrested for an accessory to murder. So that is a giant break in a 25-year-old case. And I think it's just absolutely awesome that that came because of the work of a true crime podcaster, and especially a guy that, you know, this wasn't NPR and Serial. This is an independent creator, a musician who took the charge to tell this story and investigate this case, and it has led to an arrest. So hats off to Chris Lambert. If you haven't already listened to Your Own Backyard podcast, now's the time to go binge that one, because it's just incredible the work that he's done.
Yeah, hats off to that guy. I mean, that's huge. One thing I noticed about the interview with him that you guys did was that he was really sincere and in the investigative podcasting true crime space for the right reasons, and it just all just exploded in the right direction.
It's so awesome because if I remember correctly in the interview, I asked him, like, is there going to be a season 2 or were you going to go with this? And he was like, no, I don't think so. Like he wasn't trying to start a career as a true crime podcaster. He just wanted to try to solve this case.
Yeah. And it was a local case to him that he just was really trying to get solved.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. Kudos to him. His work has been phenomenal through this whole thing.
Yeah. It's so impressive. And I'm in awe of the work that he did. And I'm proud to know the guy and been able to talk to him and to even be working in the same space where he accomplished such an amazing task. And we've seen this so many times, time and time again with, you know, Madeline Barron, with the Curtis Flowers case. There's just been, you know, the Undisclosed has had multiple exonerations. Like we've just seen real world consequences coming from a lot of these true crime podcasts. And I just think it's amazing.
Is it a first time for the, like, law enforcement to actually acknowledge the work of a podcast in the investigation?
I don't know for sure. I can't speak to that. It's the first time that I know of where they made that direct connection. You know, we did see in Serial when Anand Syed was at his appeals hearings, like in the hearings, the Serial podcast was brought up, but certainly law enforcement doesn't even acknowledge that was a wrongful conviction. But for me, this is the first time I've seen where law enforcement really tipped their hat to the independent crowdsourcing content creators that helped them solve the case.
Well, I think it's huge too, because it's not a closed case. Like a lot of those cases, those wrongful convictions are closed cases where you guys have access to these files, where this is a cold case. This is a case that's just he went out and investigated on his own with really no help.
Yeah, he just beat the streets, knocked on doors, and just tracked down witnesses and ended up, sounds like, cracking the case. So yeah, we'll move on from that. But big hats off to Chris Lambert in the Your Own Backyard podcast. Very, very, very impressed with the work that he's done. And then also the same day, or maybe the day before, Kathleen Zellner tweeted out a potential bombshell in the Stephen Avery case. And I read the motion she filed, but she filed a motion for a Brady violation, indicating for any of those that watch Making a Murderer and Making a Murderer season two, there she made I'll tell you right now, I don't know. I'm on the fence as far as Stephen Avery's guilt or innocence. After season one, I was pretty sure he was guilty. After season two, Kathleen Zellner made a good case for his innocence. And part of that case was that she believed, I think through like when they got the reports of the cadaver dogs and where they went and some other things, that she thinks that it might have actually been Steve's nephew, Bobby, who lived next door that was involved in the murder. I think there was a witness that had come forward that like saw him on the side of the road or something.
Yeah. So I read this, I think, in a People magazine article yesterday, and it said, and the nephew, Bobby, was spotted by a witness who saw him driving the victim's car, a Toyota and RAV4, and trying to hide the car somewhere, I think.
Yeah, so as the police case goes, the victim's car was found, her Toyota RAV4 was found on Stephen Avery's property, which was a kind of a linchpin of their case.
Yeah, on the family's property.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was some controversy around it already, because there was some audio recording from the dispatch log where one of the cops the night before seemed to be looking at the car, where he calls in the plate number, and then, you know, he says it's a blue RAV4, and they're like, yeah, that's what it is. So it seemed like maybe they had found it the day before, and then when it's found on the property the next day, it was like this search party and these two people, I think it was a woman and her daughter, they were just part of the search party, like go into the salvage area where all the wrecked cars are and walk straight to it and say, look, there it is. So there was already kind of some iffiness around that car. Well, what came out was that this other witness, this neighbor, according to her brief that she filed, or motion that she filed, he delivered newspapers. And he was delivering a newspaper like 4 a.m. to the Avery property on the day the car was found, and says that he saw Bobby Avery, the nephew, and another man pushing the Toyota RAV4 onto the property, like pushing it there to like hide it there. And so this is, I think, a few days after the murder. And he claims, this guy has come forward and claims that he told police, he called the police and told them he saw that happen on that day, and they never did anything with it and certainly never turned that over to the defense. The argument is that it's a Brady violation, that the police knew that this witness was out there that saw Bobby, or allegedly saw Bobby Avery and some other person pushing the car onto the Avery property, onto Steve Avery's property.
It'll be huge if they can find any proof that this actually happened.
Yeah, and that's going to be the big thing. When I look at it, I'm a little if like it's like, wow, that's a massive, that's a bombshell. But you know, as far as like how it'll play out in court, like I hope that she's got. If it's just this guy saying it happened, I feel like it probably won't help Steve Avery very much at all, because the state will say, well, there's a big reward in the case, and this guy comes forward all these years later and says that he saw this happen and he never said so before. We don't believe you. So I'm hoping there's some way to corroborate it.
That seems to be like the Achilles heel of any kind of like crowdsourcing investigation, is like the super fans or the obsessed people who get involved, and or maybe get involved for, they'll do anything to get involved sometimes. And sometimes right. they'll lie or just try to involve themselves to be celebrated in the case. And they could be completely lying, but they're just like fanboying or something.
Right. And or they could be telling the truth, but then you always have to kind of like balance that with what you're saying, you know, that like, did they really know this, or are they just trying to be involved, or are they just trying to get the reward? So I don't know anything about it, but there are a few people on the fan page asked if we would mention those two cases to update. So those are the updates. I think the Chris Lambert thing is and the Kristen Smart case, that is amazing, over the top, crazy. The Making a Murderer Stephen Avery thing is interesting. I'm curious to see how things develop with that. And with that being said, we'll get into your questions about our case, the Jennifer Jeffley case.
Okay, our first question comes from Alexis. Jennifer seems to be alibied based on the timeline presented this week. But if Bob is right about his theory that Eva told KD, Youngster, and Jennifer to lie about the screams, and they didn't really happen, then do we really know what time the murder occurred? If the attack occurred even a little earlier, say 30 minutes or an hour earlier, then Jennifer no longer has her alibi, and it feels like we are back to square one. Do any of the forensic or autopsy findings point to an actual time of death that aligns with the timeline that we've been building up until now?
No, I mean, we don't have, as kind of was the point over the beginning, the first segment of this episode, was that timing's whitewashed out of this entire case file. So all we literally have to work with, the only documented time that we have to work with, is that EMS called the time of pronounced Catalina dead at 9:15 a.m. That's all we have. From there, all we can do is try to piece things together and hypothesize about what it means. So, you know, I'm looking at someone that I'm hoping to be able to find as the nurse that performed CPR on Catalina, to ask, you know, what was the condition of the body? You know, I know as a first responder, most of the time, if they're, you know, if someone's been down, if somebody's dead for a couple hours or even an hour, then the body will be cold. It'll start to stiff. And typically you wouldn't perform CPR in that case.
Yeah, that's one thing I'm really curious about, is because I feel like, being that she's a nurse, if she came in, you know, it says she checked the pulse, meaning to me that if she started CPR after she checked the pulse, there's a reason for her to start CPR.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe she doesn't have a pulse at that point, but if she's warm or something, you know, there's a reason she started life-saving measures at that moment.
Right. But the problem is, though, then there's still other reasons. Now, the fact that she wasn't, you know, a dispatched medical personnel changes things a little bit. But, you know, as you know, there are times when EMS will show up and they'll start performing CPR on somebody that they know they can't save because they're required to until they get permission to stop. Or they might start just to try to kind of appease, make a show of it for the people that are around there. But those are all, you know, to me, I think most likely is that she thought that there was still a possibility of saving her life. And then also we have Pam Wiley, who says that she checked her pulse and says that she thought she felt a pulse. Now, you know, she may not have, but to me, that means that Catalina wasn't cold. you know, there's if you've ever had the displeasure of checking the pulse on someone who has been down for, you know, any period of time at all, even 30, 40 minutes, it's a, you know it. When you touch a body that's been dead for very long at all, you know you're touching a dead body.
How quickly would the temperature drop on a body like that?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you the exact time, how long it would take. I know that I've been to calls where somebody had been down for, you know, an hour or a little less than an hour, and they're cold. They're not stiff, but they're cold and they're blue. That's like almost immediately the color will start washing out of their face. Their lips will turn blue. The skin gets pallor, you know, because you're not circulating blood anymore. So it doesn't take long for that to happen. And again, see, I feel like the fact that Pam thought she felt a pulse means she didn't look super obviously dead. And the fact that the nurse performed CPR tells me that she wasn't obviously dead, meaning that she had not been dead very long, like within minutes, I would think, is how long she had been dead. But again, that is taking the information we have and trying to put it together to speculate kind of as far as when the time of death is. And to her point, I still maintain, I don't think the scream, I'm not saying I don't think Catalina ever screamed during the attack. I don't think that Eva calling back in a fake voice screaming back that I fell and hit my head. Personally, my personal opinion at this moment is that I don't think that happened at all. I think that was, I just doing it without any emotion attached to the case, just doing what we normally do with a statement analysis and looking for signs of veracity and signs of deception and how thing in every statement, nobody can get that part right. Nobody. And it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty weird thing, right? If you have somebody calling out, you know, if you come down the stairs and you hear a man's voice saying, I fell and hit my head, you'd think that would be pretty consistently told from everybody that witnessed it. And nobody gets it right. I don't think it happened at all. So yeah, that does open the door to say maybe the murder happened before that. But it's kind of hard in the timeline to figure out when that would have happened. And then again, based on what we just discussed with the life-saving measures that were taken, I think that she hadn't been dead more than a couple minutes.
Well, and I think we have a pretty good timeline on the phone call, the page in the responding phone call. And again, obviously, you can't really say because we're all different people, but I feel like if Jennifer had been part of this murder or committed this murder, she's not going to go answer that page. She's not going to go talk and then call the phone company and answer the phone back when the gentleman calls her back. And I think there's...
You're saying like if she had committed the murder before that?
Before that.
Yeah. Yeah, that seems odd. The other problem we have with the page is, though, that, you know, again, everything's washed out. We have we actually don't have any documentation that she got the text at 8:45. So Eva says... She looked at her pager and her text or her page that she got was at 7:44 a.m. And she says she had gone back to sleep and it was a while later when Jennifer then comes out. Jennifer says she got her page at 8:45, so which fits with all that, but it's not documented. The police, she says in one of her interviews that she showed her pager. I think when she was talking to Alan, she says, I showed, which it sounds to me like it was Peekert, the first cop that talked to her. She says, I showed them my page with the number on it and the time, presumably the time too, if she showed them the page to the cop, but he didn't write it down off, you know, no records were pulled. So we're left with, well, Jennifer says it was at 8:45. So that throws a kink into things too, because maybe it was 8:30. Maybe it was 8:40. Maybe it was at 8. I don't know.
Yeah. That's disappointing that they don't have that on record.
Yeah. It's disappointing that they don't have a lot of things on record.
Lynn has a few questions. First, she writes, can we possibly identify the female with the red color accents in her hair? It's a unique feature that four witnesses corroborate. She seems important to the crime.
So we're going to get into this. This may be the spot. I don't know where to fit it into an episode. After I recorded this episode and digging through the police file, I actually found, it's very short, a little bitty piece in the police file where Officer Swainson, Detective Swainson, actually talked to Zaragoza Garza, who was the guy that drove by and saw the woman standing there. And what he writes in his report isn't exactly the same as what Mr. Garza testified to. He says that he got home at like 7:30. The time that he got home would have been later, based on what he said then. And he says after his kids went to school, then he went to the store, which still could be 7:45, but he doesn't say 7:45. It just says he got home from work, kids went to school, and then he drove out and he saw the person. But at trial, he describes this girl with like the red hair kind of in a ponytail, and she's wearing a collared shirt that's either blue or maroon, and the shorts, which any of that, I was, as I said in the episode, so he's driving by, not looking for this woman, in what would have been a pretty, you know, that early in the morning, with the way the apartments, the way they're close together, there's not any sun shining down in there at that point, and just very quickly sees the back of this woman as he drives by and describes her in that kind of detail.
That was a big thing I was wondering about, is how much weight we can actually put into that, because exactly what you just said, if he's describing her from behind, that means he's driving through the parking lot area of the apartment complex,
right,
which means she's on the far side of the building facing away. I don't feel like there's a ton of weight you can put into his physical description.
Yeah. Well, she would be, so basically saying she was standing on Eva's stairs, staring into, which would be about halfway down the building. But still, yeah, it's probably 150 feet.
Mm-hmm.
When he didn't know he needed to be paying attention.
Yeah, and I can't imagine, you know, seeing the diagram, I can't imagine there is a long time period to see this person as you're driving through that area.
No, it's a narrow window. But then I found the police report, which I'll get posted, and he didn't describe her in that way in the police report. So once again, no recordings, nothing. No written statement was ever taken, although the report says they're going to take a written statement. And once again, when he gives the report to Swainson. So Swainson and Allen are the two detectives that I think are I think they're crooked detectives, is the way I see it. I mean, even if Jennifer's guilty, Detective Allen, for sure, in my opinion, is twisting facts to try to make his case. But in his description in the report on that was taken that day, he describes the woman as she was a black girl wearing shorts, a black t-shirt, and had two-toned hair pulled back in a ponytail, which I just saw this Monday. And I read that, I was like, oh, well, that's Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
He saw Jennifer. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. And I went back and listened. So Lynn points out here, there's four witnesses that saw Jennifer and described the two-toned hair. I read the verbiage in the reports is all exactly the same. Red Rock says she's wearing black t-shirt and had her hair pulled back in a ponytail and it's two-tone. Housen says, I don't know the girl. She's wearing a black t-shirt and her hair's pulled back in a ponytail and her hair is two-toned. June Sage looks through the peephole and says she's wearing a black t-shirt. Her hair's pulled back in a ponytail and it's two-toned. And I think there was a couple others. Every single report, it's written exactly the same. Black t-shirt, hair in a ponytail, two-toned hair. Every single report. Now, you might think, and you might be right, that, well, that's good. That's all very consistent, that was definitely Jennifer in all these circumstances. Or you might think, what are the fucking odds that these eyewitnesses all got every detail exactly the same, exactly right, and described her hair in exactly the same way?
Yeah, that's pretty tough to decipher there.
Very low odds, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, eyewitness testimony, we all know, is the worst possible. Eyewitness identifications are hard. They're the worst evidence there is. People don't get things right. And the fact that everyone, and use the same word, like I'm having a really hard time, and this is just me thinking out loud, so don't take this as me giving you facts. This is me giving you my opinion. I think it is extremely unlikely that every single person that saw Jennifer that day described her as having hair pulled back in a ponytail and it was two-toned hair, and the shirt and the black t-shirt. And then we see with and of all those people, none of them testify. We talked about earlier, like the prosecutors are picking who to testify. So we don't have a recording or even a transcript of any of these people saying that. We have Detective Swainson or Detective Allen writing into their report that they said this.
And it's both those detectives that wrote that exact verbiage? Not just not one or the other.
That's a good question because I think I have to go back because I think it may have been because on the scene all those interviews I think may have been all Swainson.
Okay,
Detective Allen may not have been a part of that. But the other thing is too that you know these reports are written. They take notes. The reports are all entered. The dates are on the reports when they're actually entered in. The reports are all typed up and entered in after the arrest, after Jennifer's arrested. So that's just food for thought.
Now, did Garza testify? That's what we talked about. He did testify.
Garza testified.
So his testimony seems different than his.
Right.
You know, and that's one thing that I'm a little hesitant on because he does describe her as a 25 or mid 20s female. So if they've led him into something, why wouldn't they lead him into a younger age?
I don't think they led him. So my theory that I'm getting at here, I don't think they led him in anything. I think they wrote down what they wanted to write down about what he said. Because when he gets on the witness stand, it's a blue or a maroon shirt. The hair looked kind of red. She looked older, like in her 20s. When they say, like when Coyne asks her about her skin tone, Jennifer's sitting right in front of him. And he says her skin tone was kind of like that lady there in the front row.
Okay.
Doesn't indicate Jennifer. But so June Sage, you would think would be a critical part of the state's case. She's an eyewitness that says, according to the report, I should backtrack. Because I said that Swainson or Allen wrote these reports, but I think it was actually, I think I'm wrong about that because I think Peekert wrote the report with June Sage. It should be a critical part of the state's case. According to her report, she describes Jennifer the exact same way everybody else does and sees her knocking on the door, going over there, hearing the screaming. Prosecution doesn't ever testify. Red Rock walks up, sees Jennifer, witnesses her, what she's wearing, where she's at, right at the front door. They don't have him testify. Housen walks up, doesn't know Jennifer's name, but knows for sure she's wearing a black t-shirt, hair in a ponytail, two-tone. They don't have him testify. The only one that they had testify that described her that way was, and there may have been, I got to go back through because I think Pam Wiley might have described her like that. It's very consistent, but they have Garza testify, and when he testifies, he doesn't say what they say that he said, which could be memory, right? It's been almost a year. But also, it's like it's pretty coincidental that everybody described her the exact same way with the exact same verbiage. And the one guy that they put on the stand gave a different description on the stand.
Next, Lynn says, and I think she's referring to the trial specifically. You'll have to clarify this, Bob. Was there ever any mention of the open prescription bottles on Catalina's kitchen counter?
Nope. They weren't collected. They weren't noted. They weren't written in the report. As though they didn't even exist. So again, we don't know what those prescriptions were.
Her last question, what pieces of physical evidence, if any, have any hope of a forensic exoneration for Jen? Seems like they didn't collect much. Did the ME testify that nail clippings were obtained? If yes, were they ever tested?
The ME did testify they did take nail clippings. No, it doesn't seem like, from what we've seen in the trial, that they ever tested them. But yeah, I think that, I mean, exoneration will be tough with forensic evidence in the crime scene only because her confession says two other people actually killed her. So no matter who those two people are, I think the state could try to spin that and say, well, yeah, so she gave us fake names, but these are the guys that actually did it. And I think it really depends who any testing comes back to. And if you, a big one. Is if, say, for example, Eva's DNA is found. Say Eva's DNA is under her fingernails. Well, now you've got a case. Same thing with the wallet. You know, if Eva's the innocent witness and Jennifer's the guilty one, but then it's and a lot of the case was built on Jennifer based on Eva throwing her under the bus, and then it comes back to it's actually Eva's DNA. But I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying if, as far as what's usable. But as far as there's still a ton that could be tested. I mean, all this evidence should be still preserved. So I think it's possible to do DNA testing on the hair. I think DNA testing on the fingernail scrapings, even the fingerprints. So the prints on the door that Jim Schraub said were unusable. You can get now DNA off those lifts. You can literally pull the tape and swab the lift for DNA. So even if you can't get a fingerprint, you can still get DNA. Mike, remember when we were in Mississippi, he told us about that.
Yeah.
So that's a possibility. So there's still a lot of possibility where we don't have testing to work with, but I think that we should still have the evidence to work with to do further testing. As far as if it exonerates Jennifer, it's going to be tough to make a case. But, you know, on that note, one thing that is missing, I'm super suspicious about the fingerprints on the glass. I had somebody on the not the fan page, but on the main Facebook page, who's a fingerprint examiner in Canada, you know, that came on and told me that I was wrong about that, that you can get fingerprints off glass. And to be clear, you can. You know, if I misstated that in the episode, I didn't mean to, but you can get fingerprints off glass. It is possible, and it is possible to do it with tape lifts. It's just the point I was making was that from what we were told by this expert that worked with us, is that it's the worst surface to do it compared to other surfaces. And so what was odd to me was that they did get prints from there, but then they said nothing else in the apartment was usable.
Well, and that again, I think you mentioned too, it's just because of the surface, whether it can absorb or not, right? So like if your oils are coming off on glass, they're not going to absorb into glass and they're going to smudge. But if you use, say, paper, which I think he said was the best method, then it's going to absorb into the paper and lock in those prints, right?
Right, exactly right, yeah. So you know, my issue wasn't really that they did find Jennifer's prints on the glass. It was like, well, how did you not find them anywhere else? We also have the issue that Verbitsky didn't dust anywhere. He only dusted in four places for prints, didn't try to get prints anywhere else. And it's possible that the other prints were unusable. But then, you know, I think it's a pretty big deal when you find out that he has a track record for doing exactly that, for which, you know, the audit doesn't say it. But what it looks to me is that he's got a track record of doing what was done here, where the prosecution needs to not have somebody else's prints on a scene because this is the person they're going after and they don't want that bad evidence. And so he says, oh, there's no usable prints. When, you know, the audit, there were three examiners that were audited, but of his, 60 of the cases were his, and 58% of them, or was it 32 of them, of his 60, were found that there were usable prints, and he said that there weren't. Like, that's a problem. And in, I think, 7 of the cases, he made an ID and didn't report it. Didn't tell them that he had ID'd prints. So, you know, that's an issue. But getting back to the prints on the glass, I thought more about it after the episode. There's no pictures of it. Like, you take pictures of fingerprints. When you dust them, that's part of kind of usually, I don't know if it's chain of evidence, but, you know, you have to be able to prove in court where things came from. So when they dust something and they get it, they'll snap a picture. So you see, like, the prints that are on the door, the handprint and that I put up on the website. You know, they took pictures of those before they did the list. When they dusted them and they showed up, they took pictures of them. I had said there was no pictures of the print from the drawer, but actually I think there is, because I noticed in the testimony that Jennifer's defense attorney says, you know, that print that you thought was in blood because it was like red. And then I look back and one of the pictures we have of the face of the drawer, there's a red looking fingerprint that I think is a finger. I think that was photographed. But the one that they use at trial, the evidence that connects Jennifer to the case is not fingerprinted anywhere, or excuse me, is not photographed anywhere. It's not documented anywhere where it was. All we know is outside of the glass. What direction were they? So it's a middle finger and an index finger. And I think this matters. Where exactly on the glass was it? And what direction was it facing? You know what I mean? So if her fingers are pointed in a direction that looks like as she's walking in the door, she's grabbing the door with her left hand. Or is it turned the other way and out closer to, you know, the edge of the patio where she could have been standing outside the fence and just touched it as she was like leaning over looking at it? Like, we don't know. We don't know the orientation. We don't know the direction they were pointed. We don't know where they were at. And the fact that, again, there's just another big absence of information that I think that we should have just... It concerns me. And again, I'm not even saying that they weren't her prints. You know, I've been under the opinion this entire time that at some point she was, you know, as I said, every single statement in one version or another, whether she's going in to check a pulse or she's going in to help with the crime, in every version of the statement, she jumps that fence at some point. So I would expect, it doesn't surprise me that her prints were there, but the way that it's been kind of covered up and the way it comes about in trial, I just find suspicious. I don't even know what it means, but something's not right.
Darlene says, after all these years, if Jennifer has any concrete knowledge of what happened that morning, don't you think she would have screamed it far and wide? Just saying. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, there's people that would disagree, but in my opinion, if she knows who killed Catalina, she would have said so by now.
Right. What does she have to lose?
Yeah, well, and she had a ton to gain at the beginning. You know, from what I understand with her attorney, she confesses, she gets arrested, and then she gets a court-appointed attorney who goes and meets with her at the beginning for when she goes in to enter her plea, and he assumed that they were just going to plea it out. He thought she was guilty. She had confessed. He comes in to do the plea, and you know, I don't know specifically what that conversation was, but I have to imagine that there was a discussion about that. Let's try to get your charge down and let's do a plea agreement. And she doesn't do it. And then she's got all this time with her mom. You know, her lawyer didn't have any contact with her for a while then, but her mom is in there, and they're. I have to believe that she was being encouraged. If you know who did this, you need to say it, or you're going to go, because I don't think that the intention of the prosecutor, to be honest with you, was to take her to trial for capital murder. I think the capital murder charge was to incentivize her to tell them who really did it. And I just don't think that she goes all the way through with this. It keeps that to herself. And then once it's over and she's convicted and now she's trying to get appeals, that she's never, ever. I talked to her attorney, Justin, yesterday, and he just told me, he's like, she doesn't know anything. She doesn't like she's not. She's very little help with his investigation because she doesn't know anything. At least that's the way he feels about it. And I agree with the comment here that I think that if she knew who did it, she would have said so by now.
Marnie says, what is Jennifer's truth? Between the statement she gave to police and the interview on Crime Watch Daily, it is so hard to know the core of her story. Did she see Catalina on the patio, or was that part of the lie to help Eva with an alibi?
I have no idea. I don't know. You know, Jennifer hasn't, the Crime Watch Daily was the first time she was given an opportunity to speak since she was arrested. She didn't testify at trial. The same shitty defense attorney is the one that did her appeal. There was no testimony there. She's never, and then Crime Watch Daily comes out 20 years later and she gives a statement there, which I know a lot of people have pointed out, like, that she's still lying. She said that she wasn't in the apartment ever when we know that she was. And I think there is a combination of things going on here. One possibility is that she's lying, which wouldn't surprise me, especially if someone doesn't know what actually happened.
Well, and there's a point too, where after a time period of lying, it becomes a truth to yourself. So if you've lied to yourself long enough about what's happening,
right,
you begin to believe that that's truly what happened.
Yeah, it kind of becomes your truth. So if she's kind of given this story as the, you know, at 15 when she goes into adult prison and, you know, it starts telling the story about what happened, that she's innocent and this is what happened, and some of that may be a lie, and then it gets repeated over and over again. One, I think you're dealing with, that could become a new false memory. Two, it could just be, you know, well, how do I change my story now? You know what I mean? How do I go on TV and say this when I've been saying this to everybody else? Or it could just be she's, you know, someone could be a liar and not be a killer. I don't know. And then you also have to deal with, everybody's putting a whole lot of weight into what she said in Crime Watch Daily, and I just don't. Because of the way that it's edited, I don't even know. I'm not saying they did anything shady, but I don't know if what we're hearing is what she said in that context. You know, that was, you know, Mike, you and I have gone to prison in Texas and interviewed Ed Ates. We know the procedure. They give you 2 hours. Mm-hmm. You go in, you set it up, and they give you a 2-hour time slot. You go in and you do the interview. So I also I've worked in television. I know how this, when you have a 2-hour window for an interview, do you know how long you interview them?
2 hours. As long as possible.
Yeah. You get everything you possibly can. And then they take it in. The editors cut that down. And we only hear maybe 2 or 3 minutes, if that, of Jennifer in that episode.
And imagine all they have to get is a soundbite of her saying the word yes and a soundbite of her saying the word no. and then cutting that, making that and editing that into an answer for any question they decide to ask.
Right.
So in post, they can have the interviewer ask a question that he didn't really ask her.
Right.
And then throw whatever answer that they have a soundbite of at the end of that to make it seem like she answered that question. Not that that happened. That's an extreme
but
look
it's possible.
At it. But, right.
But I'll tell you something similar to that happened with my show. Not in a way to distort the facts or anything, but I'll tell you a little of how the sausage is made. My interview with Pam Hobbs was really, really difficult. She was not in good shape when we were doing the interview, and I interviewed her for 5 hours all day. I mean, in and out, taking breaks, coming in, and it was so hard to keep her on track to string her thoughts together. And so once she finally did, and she was able to say what she wanted to say, but it wasn't pieced together in the right places, meaning like she was kind of all over the place, right? So she answers part of I'd ask her a question, she'd answer part of it and then go off on a tangent about something else. We'd bring her back, you know, I try to bring her back in to finish answering the question, then she'd continue on and then go off in a different direction. And then, so like this would happen. And then, so the editors then would like take it and kind of piece all that together, Frankenstein it together. So it's still what she said. They didn't change the context or the words of what she said. They just made it sound cleaner. And then they actually had me do VOs and like re-ask the question in the way that she answered it. And that's just how it works in TV, you know? So like I asked a question this way and she kind of answered it a different way. Answered the question, but it didn't fit with what I said. So they'll have you edit things. And what you look for, what I look for when I'm watching like Crime Watch Daily, if someone is speaking, if they're interviewing someone and someone is speaking, and while they're speaking, the camera cuts away to B-roll or another shot, they've edited something together. So you can't, and what I mean by that is you can't put the camera on someone's face and then cut to the beginning of their sentence and then cut something out of the middle and cut to the end of their sentence because you'll see the camera jump. So the way they do that is because they can edit audio all they want to. And if they need to make an audio cut, then they'll cut the screen to while someone's talking, all of a sudden it's panning a view of the outside of the prison and then comes back to them talking. Most of the time, I mean, some of that's just artistic stuff, but that's also a place where they can make edits. And again, I'm not accusing Crime Watch Daily and by any means of doing anything, you know, irresponsible or changing context on purpose, but especially when somebody doesn't understand the full significance of the case. So the part where, you know, where she says, I was never in the apartment, they might not understand that that's a big deal because maybe they don't know about the fingerprints in her statement where she said that she was in the apartment. And that could have been an answer to, as Mike said, a completely different question. You know, they could have said, you know, they might have been talking about the wall. Did you ever go back in the apartment after the police were there? And she said, no, I never went in the apartment after that. And that little, you see what I mean? I'm not making excuses. All I'm telling you is I can't rely on what she said in Crime Watch Daily as that's her truth. Because I have no idea what she actually said, in what context, in what order, what actual questions were asked before it was edited. So I don't know. I have no idea what the short answer to your question is. I don't know what her actual truth is. And that's why we're looking at the evidence so we can just figure out what happened. And I said, if you want a good example of it, go watch The Forgotten West Memphis 3 and look at the 10-minute interview. You see maybe a total 5 or 10 minutes of me interviewing Pam. And know that was a 5 to 6 hour interview, and then watch how the cuts are made, and you'll see that's how. And again, I want to stress everything. And Pam's watched it, and she agrees with everything. You know, nobody has a problem with it. What was aired is what she said, but it took a lot of work to make it seem like a flowing conversation.
Heather says Truesdale said he thought, quote, it was around 9:45 a.m. when he finished checking the fire extinguishers around the complex, and that was when he went to Catalina's apartment. We now have an ME saying Catalina died at 9:15, which is before Truesdale got there. Could daylight savings time be part of the reason that timings are off? The clocks were forward on Sunday the 27th. Catalina died on Tuesday the 29th. Also, did pagers need to have timings manually adjusted, or was it automatic?
I don't remember if you had to manually adjust them or not. I think it depends on which pager. So I had a series of pagers at that time. So my first pager was the classic Motorola that just had like two buttons on top and just the little LED screen. And then for work a couple of years later, actually when I worked in an apartment complex as a maintenance tech, it was a bigger pager that you could actually do text pages on. Like people could, you could type it on a computer, you could call and speak it and they would text it and send it out. And that one seemed like that one might have upped, like the text came in might have been timestamped with whatever it got from the computer, maybe. I don't know about the pager. As far as Truesdale, I don't know. I mean, he said he thinks it was about 9:45. So already, like, okay, well, what does that mean? Could that mean as early as 9? Could it mean 9:15? Or could it be the time difference, the time change difference? I think that that's also a possibility. But the only time that I'm comfortable actually relying on is the EMS time, because that's a big deal. Times are very important when it comes to EMS reports. There's no way that the ambulance has gone two full days of working and hasn't set their clocks back or is sprung their clocks forward. That time is the only one I'm comfortable with. And you know, when somebody says they think something happened at about this time and it's 2 hours after or 2 days after the time changed, I'm not so comfortable with that.
Christina says, do you have the actual DNA lab reports? And if so, will you share them?
If I find them, I'll share them. They're not in the police file. I need to go through more of the DA's file. It's harder to, I couldn't make that one a searchable text document because of the way it's formatted, but I don't think it's in there either. And it may be in there. And so in that production from the DA, there are, I don't know how many, a bunch of pages that are fully redacted. I mean, the entire page is a big black box of redaction. So I don't know what was in those redactions. And it wasn't, the report wasn't entered in as evidence at trial. The DNA analysts weren't given a copy of their report for reference, which was also, you know, when your DNA expert shouldn't be testifying for six pages. You know, this is ridiculous. There was no attention, or there was a whole lot of attention paid to how the DNA evidence came out, especially in its brevity and how it came out like that. But yeah, normally it'd be like, well, what'd you find here? Here's a copy of your report for your reference. And we want to enter in this into evidence as an exhibit. None of that was done. So I, as far as I know, it's not in the file that I have.
Aaron says, since there's evidence that the fingerprint specialist obviously had some issues with accuracy, is that something that can be used in order to get a retrial?
I doubt it. You'd have to. All you could do is if you re-examined the prints from the glass and determined that they actually weren't Jennifer's, then maybe. But then you're still going to fight against the fact that a judge or the CCA in Texas will say, okay, so that's not her fingerprint on the glass, but she still confessed. So we're not overturning the conviction. I don't think it's going to help her, but again, it's one of those things where it won't help her in of itself, but hers is a case where there's going to have to be a lot of little elements to prove her innocence. So to get to an actual innocence claim, which I think is where Justin is going with this, is, so even though that by itself might not help, but if you have, say you find, hypothetically, you find Eva's DNA on the wallet in the apartment, and maybe you find Eva's DNA on those blood swabs, and you find a match to the DNA that was found on the scene, you find a match and find out that it's nobody that has any connection to Jennifer, or maybe it's somebody that has a connection to Eva. You know, so now you're starting to build this case, and then you're like, and there's this, on top of that, there's this fingerprint issue. And on top of that, in her confession, she has the size of the murder weapon wrong. And she has the location of things wrong and the timings. You know, so some of those little things that wouldn't help by themselves, I think when you put them all together, they're going to help with, you know, if Jennifer is indeed innocent, and I don't know that she is, but I personally, my opinion right now is that she is. But if she's indeed innocent, then all of that will come together to make the case for her innocence.
Luke says, the two unknown DNA profiles they found, where were they found? On Catalina's body, the wall, the knife drawer? And were they compared against the profiles of the first responders or maintenance guy or anyone else who had a purpose to enter the scene? And while we're talking about DNA, Michelle says, do the two unknown DNA profiles still exist? They weren't compared against anyone but Jennifer's and Catalina's back then, but can't they be run through the database now to get a possible match?
Yeah, depending on, you know, the database has requirements as far as, you know, how many alleles or loci that are in the profile. So I don't know if they're strong enough samples to run through a database. Where they were found, they were all found. The only DNA testing that they did that we know of is they took some of the ceramic pieces, not the piece that was covered in Catalina's blood, but they took some of the broken ceramic pieces that had smaller blood stains on them, and they swabbed six of those smaller blood stains from the ceramic pottery, from various pieces of it, and that's where they found the two unknown profiles in those blood stains. And no, it wasn't compared to anybody else who may have been there. So it wasn't, they didn't compare it to Keith Truesdale. They didn't compare it to Pam Wiley. They didn't compare it to Doris Gibson, the nurse. They didn't compare it to anybody else. They literally, that's why the episode was titled Blinders. They looked for evidence to match, to put Jennifer on the crime scene. And when it didn't match her, they left it.
Our last question comes from Michelle. With Coyne asking so many questions about the blood spatter and blood transfer, where was he going with this exactly? Does it show the position of the killer in relation to Catalina, which might explain the strange slashes across her chest? Would the killer have minimal or lots of blood on them? Was the killer kneeling or crouching over her while stabbing, and was the first blow struck while she was upright? Did they test for prints from the broken pottery if the killer didn't wear gloves?
I kind of had a question about that too, of where the blood spatter conversation came from, because it seems kind of out of place for him.
If you read in the transcript, it's mind-numbing. Verbitsky gives us all this testimony, very little testimony about the evidence. And then it's like, okay, here comes Cross. Now we're going to find out, you know, the stuff that the prosecution didn't want to talk about, which is usually what happens in Cross. And he just goes on and on and on about, I mean, and it's literally, he's not asking him about the scene. He said, so you said there was blood spatter. And he's like, yeah. He said, well, so is blood spatter. Where was their blood spatter? And is this blood spatter? Well, that's blood transfer. What's the difference between transfer and spatter? And he explains what the difference is. So you think there's blood transfer spatter? It goes on like that for pages and pages, and then he never makes a point when it's over with. I have no idea what he was getting at. All I could think of is that he's trying to make a case that the killer would have blood all over them. Is all I can think of. But he tees it up and never hits it. Like I have no idea where he was going with it. As far as dusting for prints, no, they didn't dust for prints as far as I know. And I have to go back and review Verbitsky's testimony, but it didn't sound like he dusted for prints on the pottery. He dusted for just the places where he thought was relevant to the crime scene, and that was it. And then, you know, and then as far as any other evidence, I mean, was anybody else shocked by the fact that he didn't collect anything?
No, that's really strange that he didn't, you know, none of the knives, the pill bottles, the purses. They ignored the glasses, which, you know, we've talked about multiple times now, but the glasses seem like it, at least talk about them.
Yeah, the drinking glasses never brought up nothing. And I thought, maybe I'm going to read this and he's going to say there's some weird reason for this drinking. Nope, never brings it up. And I don't think the state, it's cropped out of these, of the photos, or, you know, or the photos they used you never see like a clear picture of these drinking glasses. You can just get them in the video. You see them for a second. And they're kind of off to the side. Nothing's done. They don't collect. He doesn't collect anything as evidence. It's just crazy. I mean, I've looked at a lot of murder cases, and usually they just collect everything. They collect everything as evidence, just in case it could be used later. And Verbitsky spent 2 hours on the crime scene, and then left, and that was it. And didn't collect anything. Didn't document anything. It's just an absolute mess. And with that, that is Mike Sutton's last question. So we're going to go ahead and wrap this up for this week's episode, main episode Sunday. We have something special for you. We had an interview fall through on us this week, so we had to kind of scramble to figure out what we were going to do. And what we ended up landing on is we're going to have a roundtable discussion with myself and five listeners. We got on a Zoom call last night, spent about an hour just talking about the case. Most of the people that were on the call with me, these listeners, either lean towards guilty or are on the fence and think Jennifer might be involved. So it was a great conversation. It's kind of given the other side, because I know that I keep telling you I think she's innocent. So you're going to hear from some people that maybe think she's guilty or are leaning that way. We have a really, really good conversation, I think. So that's coming up on Sunday. If you're looking for something else to listen to, tomorrow morning, that Chris Lambert episode will be dropping on True Crime Binge. It's the one that we already did in Season 9. And this week's episode that just aired on Wednesday on True Crime Binge is really cool. I interviewed Justine Harmon. She's the host of the OC Swingers podcast. It's brand new. There's only 4 episodes out so far, and it's number 1 in the iTunes chart. Phenomenal podcast. Really cool conversation. So if you get a chance, please check that out. And with that being said, thank you all for listening. Make sure you tune into the roundtable on Sunday, and we'll talk to you again next week. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd really like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, ad-free versions of all of our episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, Truth and Justice Pod. Just click the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING, and Zach is at Z2TheQ. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Say goodbye to the dish and hello to Sky Stream, the new way to get Sky over Wi-Fi. So you can get unmissable Sky shows like The Last of Us and Succession, as well as Netflix and Discovery Plus, and loads more, all in one subscription for £26 a month. Oh, and next day delivery with no upfront fee. Sky Stream, TV simplified. Head to sky.com. Requires Sky Stream and broadband minimum speed 10 megabits per second, 18-month minimum term. Cut-off times apply for next day delivery. Excludes bank holiday. 18 plus, terms apply.